Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, November 7, 2013. You won't be shocked to hear that the phone company's been selling your call records to the CIA.
We don't know.
Hi, my name is Jeannie, and I work for the phone company.
We don't know.
Hello, I'm Larry, and I work for the phone company.
We don't know.
I'm Nancy, and I don't know what I'm doing.
We don't know what we're doing.
When you work for the only phone company in town, you don't have to know what you're doing, and there's really nothing anybody can do about it. You can try to complain, but you probably won't get through. The phone company.
We don't know what we're doing.
Well, you can tell by the low sound quality of that clip that that's an ancient piece. It goes back to the 1960s. And it's been dubbed from a disc to a tape and then digitized, and that's why it doesn't sound clean and crisp. But I think the nostalgia value of it is worth it. And we have confirmed today what I have known from my sources for almost 10 years now, and that is that the phone companies not only capitulated to the demands of the government to surveil Americans in violation of law and constitution, but they have profited handsomely from it in the process. And the New York Times and reporter Charlie Savage confirmed today that the CIA pays AT&T more than $10 million a year to assist with overseas counterterrorism investigations by exploiting the company's vast database of phone records, which includes Americans' international calls. This occurs under a voluntary contract, not under subpoena or court orders. And this is separate from the phone record collection of the NSA. The CIA supplies phone numbers of overseas terrorism suspects, and AT&T searches its database and provides records of calls that might help them identify more about who's calling who and what they're talking about. Now, there's no intimation here that any of these calls are intercepted or recorded. This is what they call metadata. But it shows that our focus on this program and elsewhere, on the NSA, is only a tip of that proverbial iceberg. There are 16 known intelligence arms in the U.S. intelligence community. The NSA is just one of those. The CIA is just one of those. And I'm sure over at, for example, the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, they're sweating but breathing regularly, saying, well, at least there's no heat on us yet. And once again, the government tells us that the CIA safeguards the privacy of Americans by blacking out some of the digits of numbers that originate or, you know, connect in the United States. And as you know, if you've got the area code and the prefix, you can get very close to identifying where those people are and even who they might be. And Charlie Savage acknowledges AT&T has a history of working with the government. It helped facilitate the Bush administration's euphemized warrantless surveillance program. Warrantless equals illegal, in my view. By allowing the NSA to install secret equipment in its phone and switch facilities. And that's what we have been disclosing for years now, based on the eyewitness testimony of former AT&T technician Mark Klein, who exposed the collaboration in San Francisco. And AT&T is also one of three phone companies that has embedded its employees at the FBI. They did that from 2003 to around 2007. And they used company databases to provide quick analysis of call records. So the incestuous connections between the phone companies and the surveillance state is very clear. And that's why they got immunity in the so-called FISA reform of 2008. That was the piece that candidate Obama said he was against and would vote against. After he got the nomination, he voted for it, and I don't believe he's ever had to address that issue since. And so it's just another drip, drip, drip from the summer of leaks that's now moved into the autumn of leaks. And in a conversation yesterday that was released this morning at BoilingFrogsPost.com, I spoke with State Department whistleblower Peter Van Buren. And he correctly corrected an assumption on my part. I said, you know, Peter, the NSA should have figured out by now everything that Ed Snowden grabbed from them. The data he copied, the files he entered. And Van Buren politely but correctly corrected me. And he said, Peter, don't be so sure. Number one, you're assuming a level of spycraft on the part of the NSA that may not be accurate. And number two, you don't know how clever, how careful, how good a hacker Ed Snowden actually was. And so on that point, I'm grateful to Mr. Van Buren. You can hear that interview right now at BoilingFrogsPost.com. It's reserved for subscribers there at Sibel Edmonds' site. But it'll be public in 2 weeks, just like the podcast on my site. So if you want to hear that, make a note and you'll be able to access it with or without a subscription. I certainly encourage you to support BoilingFrogsPost.com to the extent you are financially able. Well, I applaud Al Gore, the former vice president, the man who was elected and then rejected by the Supreme Court in 2000. He's been very cautious and careful. He likes to focus on climate change, and he published a book this year, a big picture look at the need for systemic change in global politics. And he generally doesn't criticize. He was pretty quiet during the Bush era, and he's been fairly quiet during the Obama reign. But at a speech at McGill University in Montreal on Tuesday of this week, he described the activities of the NSA as outrageous and completely unacceptable, and said that Ed Snowden has revealed evidence of crimes against the U.S. Constitution. Now, Gore, a moderate guy, he's never been a flaming liberal. He's a guy who spent 8 years with access to our top secrets as a member of the National Security Council in the White House. And so it is remarkable that he's breaking ranks with his fellow individuals who are briefed into the black operations of our government. Here's the quote. He has revealed evidence of what appears to be crimes against the Constitution of the United States. He says that the NSA's efforts to monitor communications have gone to absurd lengths. When you are looking for a needle in a haystack, it's not always wise to pile more hay on the haystack. And he predicts that there will be rollbacks. Well, that to me is a minimum. We not only need rollbacks, but as I've stated, I want to see the FISA court dismantled. I want to see Clapper and Alexander not only fired, but prosecuted for their perjury. And I want to see the mission of the NSA and other agencies reinforced that they cannot spy on American persons in the United States. Roger Shuler, the intrepid journalist in Alabama who's exposed corruption in the courts there, remains locked up at the Shelby County Jail in Columbiana, Alabama today. And I learned via a Facebook post that there is a hearing scheduled for 1 week from today on the 14th of November. And from the sketchy information I have, it appears the hearing is not about the contempt citation that keeps Roger Shuler locked up indefinitely, but it's about the underlying injunction that was issued, and it could be a showdown trying to force him to capitulate to this illegal and unconstitutional demand by a very sketchy court presided over by a retired judge called out of retirement by a Supreme Court justice. And so we will continue to follow the events there in Alabama. I encourage you to go to legalschnauzer.blogspot.com, and if you're able to support the Shuler family at this critical time, I hope you will. And while we're talking about people who support us, Michael Donahue just moments ago took out a 24-hour pass. You know you can do that for just $1. You go to peterbcollins.com, and you can binge listen and download as much as you want in a 24-hour period. It's our way of introducing you to the Peter B. Collins podcast site, And Michael, thanks for dropping by. Maybe you stopped in to get a quick listen to the Bill Ayers Bernadine Dorn interview that we posted yesterday. Well, if you care to take out a new annual subscription, Mr. Donahue, or anyone else, I have secured 5 copies of Bill Ayers' powerful new memoir called Public Enemy. And the first 5 new annual subscribers who say, I want the Bill Ayers book, that is your bonus book, along with the bag of Kona coffee. And I'd be happy to send those along with your new annual subscription. Just go to my website, peterbcollins.com, under my picture on the homepage, follow the links to sign up. And I am very grateful to those who support our efforts here. The other way you can do it is by steering your web business to GoDaddy.com. Right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the rates start at the low, low price of $1.99 a month, and they'll throw in your domain name free. Click on the link in the show file for this podcast at PeterBCollins.com for another screaming deal at GoDaddy.com. Well, the Senate actually did something. Something that moves in a progressive direction. Can you believe it? Now, I have held off on reporting on the developing story here because I actually thought that right-wing Republicans would ultimately kill this with a filibuster. The issue in question is called ENDA, and it is the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, extending protections for the first time to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. And I think this is very important. What is also significant is that 10 Republicans broke ranks with the Christian right and those who pander to them and actually voted for this. Now, it's not a perfect bill, as we'll note here in just a moment, but I think it's an important step forward, and it gets beyond the hysterical homophobia that has held sway in the Republican Party. And with defectors like Senator Rob Portman, who now supports marriage equality because he has a gay son, we're seeing some defections. And I think that's a good thing. Now, I want to credit a group called Secular Americans, who sent me a press release identifying some of the problems with this bill. Now, first of all, 55 senators voted against a very bad amendment by Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, which would have widened the exemptions for religious groups to the point where that exemption would be big enough to drive a bus full of gay wedding parties right through it. But this group, the Secular Coalition, makes an important point that there are carve-outs that permit religious groups to continue to discriminate based on gender identity, sexual orientation, in their employment practices. And the whole idea of ending discrimination is to make it apply generally. And so when you say that, you know, religious groups can discriminate, why? Because God told them to? I mean, I find that incoherent, even as a person who is not religious. And I really think that we have a problem in this country that there is too great an influence of religious people on our policies. And we need to allow for freedom from religion. We cannot exempt religious organizations from fundamental protection of the rights of individuals. We'll see if that can be cleaned up in the future, but this is a good first step. Our friend Gareth Porter, who covers foreign policy issues and has a sharp analytical mind, has posted an article that I'll link to in the show file for this podcast regarding the November 1st drone strike in Pakistan that reportedly killed Taliban leader Haqimullah Massoud. Now, I say reportedly because by all accounts he's dead, and they've acknowledged that on his side that he has been martyred. But skepticism is indicated because this is the third time that we have claimed to kill Haqimullah Massoud. Now, as Porter points out, there are some important, very important considerations about this November 1st drone strike. First of all, it appears to have snuffed out a peace process that had started in the region. And the Pakistanis, whose new prime minister was here in Washington just a few weeks ago and thought he had brokered a new understanding with President Obama not to conduct future drone strikes. Well, Porter reports that the CIA trumped the president's agreement with Nawaz Sharif and went ahead with this strike as payback to Massoud because they're still boiling over his successful use of a double agent who was able to get into that forward base Chapman in Afghanistan and kill six or seven Americans, including some CIA officers. And Porter points out in this article that the CIA appears to be able to, at will, overrule presidential policies. Now, maybe the president acceded to this. I certainly hope he was involved. But it's very troubling that there was an effort to broker peace in Afghanistan on the part of the Pakistani Taliban, which is different from the Afghan Taliban. And there were other leaders who were sitting down, and certainly the exit of the United States from Afghanistan is one of the things that was driving this. The strategy of engaging the Taliban in peace talks, which was supported by the unanimous agreement of an all-parties conference on September 9th of this year, was not simply an expression of naivete about the Taliban, as suggested by a November 3rd New York Times article on Pakistani reaction to the drone strike. And so, the other thing we have to look at here is that back on May 23rd, Obama gave his speech where he basically was begging us to stop him from killing more people with drones. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Pakistan in August or early September and said that he thought an end to our drone program was very near. Then Sharif comes to the U.S. in October and thinks he has assurances that it's over or it will be rare. And we turn around, violate their sovereignty, and blow up the peace process as we settle a personal score for leaders at the CIA. It's really mind-boggling to try to figure out who's in charge and what rationale is driving these policies. Now, speaking of drones, the Federal Aviation Administration today released their initial plan, and it's funny, this is about control of airspace, and it's called a roadmap. Yes, the roadmap for airspace management, because Congress has ordered it to put a plan into effect by September of 2015 to allow unmanned aerial craft to fly with manned aerial craft. Coordinating all that, I think, is going to be problematic. FAA Administrator Michael Huerta said that new rules, standards, and policies are needed to ensure that U.S. aviation regulations and safety rules remain the world's gold standard. Well, I want to be very clear. Last week, I was over in Alameda, which is next to Oakland, on a decommissioned U.S. aircraft carrier, the Hornet. And up on the flight deck, there were several science geeks who were demonstrating drones. And these are little craft, the kind of thing you think about, you know, you get a Radio Shack and fly in the park. But they're highly sophisticated. And I don't say that all drones are bad. But how do we differentiate? If we permit unmanned aerial vehicles to be used for search and rescue, to be used for legitimate law enforcement purposes, and I underscore legitimate, and at what point do we permit, say, a county sheriff to arm a drone? He might say, well, we're going to shoot a drug kingpin because he's heavily armed and we don't want to put our deputies at risk. And so it's a slippery slope. And the use of drones for surveillance by public agencies, by private parties. What if I want to have some fun and fly a drone over the backyard of a neighbor who is sunbathing in the nude? That's not really my kink, but it's an example of how Private individuals using these aircraft could violate the rights of other people. And once we, you know, let this drone genie off the runway, it's kind of hard to call him back. My friend and colleague Jason Leopold has done it again. He published part one of a blockbuster series at Al Jazeera's website today, based on the secret diaries of Abu Zubaydah. And I give Leopold credit. This guy is so persistent and tenacious. A couple of years ago, he met Abu Zubaydah's younger brother, who's very different from his jihadi older brother. Lives in Florida, drives a Mercedes, buys into the American dream. They're very different. And somehow, Leopold got copies of Abu Zubaydah's personal diaries. And part one was published today at Al Jazeera. I'm going to wait for additional installments to be published, and then we'll get an interview with Jason, probably in the next week or so, so that he can share this trove of information that he has just recently accessed and published. We're learning now that Yasser Arafat may have been assassinated by poisoning using polonium-210. Now, this has been something that was suspected since he got sick unexpectedly and died in 2004. He complained that he fell sick after a meal, and at the age of 75, he was otherwise pretty healthy. 4 weeks later, he was dead, and after exhuming his body a year ago, Swiss forensic scientists have delivered a report finding significant presence of polonium-210. Now, I want to be clear here that the language of the report is not conclusive. The Swiss report said the results moderately support the proposition that the death was the consequences of poisoning with polonium-210. The widow of Yasser Arafat, Suha, flatly says that this is the crime of the century. It's shocking. I remember how Yasser was shrinking in the hospital, how in his eyes there were a lot of questions. Death is a fate in life. It's everybody's fate. But when it's poisoned, it's terrible. We are mourning him again now. And if, in fact, he was poisoned and killed in that manner, there isn't a real long list of suspects. I don't think I even have to name the nation that is most likely suspected in this case. The other day we told you how the billionaire Koch brothers have been steering their millions and billions into political campaigns down at the lowest level. In a town of 20,000 in Iowa called Coralville, Americans for Prosperity, the political group funded by the Koch brothers, they got active in a local election. Now, they say they got involved because this little town of 20,000 people has a relatively huge debt of $280 million. Now, I have no idea if that $280 million is a good debt that's secured by public property or assets, or if it's a bad debt with no, you know, insufficient revenues to cover it. I simply don't know. What we do know is that the entry of Americans for Prosperity and the Koch brothers completely backfired. It provoked so much anger that the race became as much a referendum on AFP's involvement as on the issues themselves. All three incumbents who ran won their seats, and the guy re-elected mayor, John Lundell, even got a call from Joe Biden in the White House, letting him know that they had been keeping an eye on Coralville, Iowa. Now, maybe that signals more about Joe Biden's presidential aspirations than it does about the White House following the political dollars of the Koch brothers. And finally today, I want to pull two different reports together. Our friend Steve Horn, our leading contributor on fracking, environmental issues, and climate change, put up a post the other day taking to task the MSNBC network, which recently revamped its website. And Steve put up a screenshot. I haven't actually visited the site since it's been updated. But he said they have these interstitial web ads. So next to a progressive leaning forward story by Ed Schultz or Stephanie Miller. I'm mixing up my lefty lesbians. Rachel Maddow, Lawrence O'Donnell, any of those folks. And right next to it is an ad for example, the American Natural Gas Association or the American Petroleum Institute. And so NBC, through its MSNBC cable channel, is trying to attract the eyeballs of liberals and progressives with so-called liberal and progressive content and hosts. And then they sell ads to the people who are diametrically opposed to the positions of those viewers and the hosts that attract them to the network and the website. Now, NBC has no obligation to purify its advertising and only supply, you know, friendly views to the viewers who come to their channel. But I think it's important to note a sellout of this type. And you might want to notify the folks at the National Broadcasting Corporation of your thoughts. And separate but connected in some ways, Jon Stewart skewered CNN the other night on The Daily Show, and it was something I had never heard of before. One of the morning shows that's on pre-dawn here on the West Coast, so I never even have an opportunity to see it, is a kind of breezy chat show, and occasionally the hosts move from their desk set to a couch set. Now, I don't have any problem with that. I just did an election night show the other night locally on cable here in Marin County, and we had a desk set, and then I moved over to conduct interviews with people to a lounge chair setup. It's very common. But when I made my move from the desk to the couch, I didn't say we're going to the couch, and it didn't trigger an advertisement, say, from BP, about what a wonderful job they're doing cleaning up the Gulf of Mexico. But that's exactly what happens on CNN. Instead of moving from the desk to the couch during a commercial break, they turn it into a dramatic sequence. And as the overpaid and overcoiffed anchors move from the desk to the couch, we see them and the lights go down, and, you know, it's about a 15-second process. And meanwhile, they roll in a commercial from BP on the other half of the screen. And I suppose they feel they have a captive audience because we're so enthralled and concerned and interested about what's going to happen when they get to the couch. It's just another desperate move on CNN's part to hold the small audience they have and force them to watch a commercial so that they can extract higher rates from their advertisers. Hey, thanks for joining me for news and comment. You are authorized to share this podcast with absolutely anyone, and I hope you will.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.